The Curbsiders Teach podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions.
Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the speakers and should not be interpreted to reflect the official policy or position of any entity. You should always do your homework and give us any feedback.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders Teach Season 6, our series on health professions education. I'm Dr. Molly Hoyblein, and I had the pleasure of sitting down in person today with my co-host, Dr. Mike Cheng. On today's episode, we are on site at the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine, AIM Week 26, where we get to discuss implications of artificial intelligence on medical education. Before we get started with that, Mike, will you remind the audience what we do on this show?
Yeah, of course. We are the health professions podcast for all things education. We use expert interviews to bring you teaching pearls and practice-changing knowledge to inspire the next generation of clinician educators. We have such a great conversation with our guests where we review the take-home points from a few different workshops and pre-course at the Academic Internal Medicine Week 2026, the National Conference of the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine. And these all relate to the benefits of AI for medical education and how to prepare for the AI era.
We have two great guests today. The first is Dr. Eric Burnett, who's a hospitalist, assistant professor of medicine, and IM residency APD at the Columbia University Irving Medical Center, presenting on behalf of Drs. Rex Hermanson and Eve Merrill from their workshop, Artificial Intelligence, Real Implications, Preparing Clinical Educators for the AI Era.
We also have Dr. Alexander Glazer, PD of the IM residency program at Pennsylvania Hospital, generalist and assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine, presenting on behalf of himself and the pre-course planning committee from AIM Week 2026 for the pre-course session they organized titled From Insight to Impact, Developing Yourself as a Next Generation Faculty Leader in AI.
I hope you enjoy this conversation. It is so fun to sit down in person, but sometimes we do have to deal with noise in the conference center. So I do apologize to all of our listeners if you can hear the lively discussion happening next door. Enjoy the show.
Well, thanks both of you for joining us today, Dr. Eric Burnett, as well as Dr. Alexander Glazer. Is it okay if we call you Eric and Alex respectively for this recording?
Sure.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Well, thank you for coming on the show. And let's start with some rapid fire questions just so we and our listeners can get to know you a little bit better. So if you can give us a one liner to describe yourself and include something from outside of medicine.
Sure. So my name is Eric Burnett. I'm an academic hospitalist at Columbia, one of the associate program directors for the medicine residency there. Something that I'm doing outside of medicine, I'm an avid reader. I'm currently very obsessed with the Dungeon Crawler Carl series and very much waiting for the 8th installment, which is coming out next month.
What's that series about?
Oh, whenever you try to explain it, it's like a 2-year-old trying to explain a story. It's basically a post-apocalyptic novel where aliens invade the Earth and basically turn the survivors into these like competitors in this underground dungeon crawl. And it's like a Dungeons and Dragons meets Game of Thrones meets Hunger Games. So if you like any of those things, it's a very ridiculous concept. But once you read the first book, you're hooked. And I've already converted many, many people into Dungeon Crawler Carl fans. So,
yeah, no, it sounds intense, but also broadly appealing.
Yeah,
and a good escape from our regular day to day.
Yeah, it definitely is.
Alex, you wanna?
So I'm Alex Glazer, the residency program director at Pennsylvania Hospital, the nation's first hospital. We're celebrating our 275th birthday this year, which is very exciting.
And I am a Pensy alum.
That's right.
Proud Pensy alum.
I'm in my 6th year as the program director, and I'm a member of APTIM's program planning committee. Outside of medicine, I'm the father of 2, and I've been to 43 states, and I'm excited because I have not been to Kentucky, which is where the fall APTIM meeting is in October.
We just did a recording earlier, so we're hearing everybody's bucket list. So I like it. So how's it been so far at AIM for you guys? Alex, we can start with you. Kind of what's your experience been at the conference and anything that surprised you or kind of a quick take home you want to share that you really resonated with you?
I mean, the biggest surprise is that Seattle is warm and sunny. People have been lying to me clearly for the last decade. No, it's been absolutely beautiful, and the convention center has been great. I think I have been most pleasantly surprised by the two plenaries yesterday, that the mentorship plenary was phenomenal. I really got a lot of great takeaways from that. And then the plenary that we had in the afternoon was also just a really engaging and insightful plenary about finances and GME. I took a lot out of that. So I've really enjoyed those two sessions in particular.
Yeah, I mean, I love coming to this conference every year. I love being around like-minded people, medical educators. And I was pleasantly surprised to see like how many workshops are about AI and just sort of all the different aspects of it. I think it's very obviously a very hot topic, which is why we're all here today. So I've been helping, you know, going to these conferences and going to these workshops to help sort of augment my own knowledge about AI, which has been great.
And, you know, it's this unique situation where we're obviously recording here at AIM Week. And I wanted to ask both of you, I know, Eric, you did a workshop, and then I know, Alex, you were involved in planning the pre-course revolved around AI. Wanted to ask if you both can share about what made you passionate about AI, just AI in education, and how you decided to be involved in the topic.
Yeah, I think the thing that really drove me towards it is that I knew so many of my learners were using it. So I wanted to sort of be ahead of the curve and work with them. And I definitely didn't want to be left in the dust because I know like a lot of my learners are, you know, Gen Z. They're very, very good with technology. So I saw them using this and I wanted, it obviously has like a tremendous potential for medical education. So I just wanted to sort of be on the ground floor to help, especially guide them in using it sustainably and appropriately in the medical education space.
Mine was actually really linear. I was sitting at an Aptum plenary 2 years ago from Adam Rodman from one of the Harvard programs talking about just general insights into early AI. And I was sitting next to my program coordinator, Layla, who is phenomenal. And we were listening to this early stuff about AI, and we were getting ready to write our fellowship letters. And we were like, I bet AI could do this so easily for us. And then we came up with the whole process to have AI summarize narratives of evaluations to help us feed into the fellowship letters. And then we did that. We ended up submitting it as a workshop for AIM Week last year, but instead we're asked to do a plenary. And so we actually ended up getting on stage, Layla and I, to do this plenary. And then when the pre-courses were getting organized for this year, because I'd done a plenary, now I'm helping to run this pre-course, and it's just been a very linear journey that really started from me and my coordinator having an idea in a room in front of somebody at Aptum a couple of years ago, which is exciting.
Amazing. Well, nice example of kind of how we all learn from each other and can inspire us all to grow and keep expanding things. And I think that is a really special thing about the Alliance community of just really a lot of great ideas floating around and being able to see and hear what other people are doing at other institutions can be pretty inspiring. Should we jump into a case?
Yeah, that sounds good.
We've got our case from Kashlak Memorial. Joseph is an assistant professor, and he precepts residents in clinic and on the wards while managing a primary care panel that's busy. He's noticed growing use of AI by both patients and trainees, but he feels uncertain and skeptical about it himself. I love this little part that you added in here. Joseph is not an early adopter of technology and feels a little lost and suspicious as he rarely uses AI, aside from when he's forced to with his internet search engine or when the pharmacy he calls has an annoying AI operator. He comes to you for guidance on understanding and using AI to better support patient care and education. So we'll put this to both of you, but maybe Eric, we can start with you. As Joseph approaches you, and he clearly has a mixture of suspicion and also some curiosity about AI, what would you say are some of the benefits of AI as it pertains to health professions education?
Yeah, I think like a healthy skepticism of AI is perfectly normal, especially if you're a late adopter. But I think it has, like I mentioned before, like really tremendous potential in the medical education space. And it really depends on what you do. So I try to ask people who are a little skeptical, like, what is it that you do? What is your niche? And there's like a way that AI can help you. Like I do a lot of remediation for like the UME and GME space. And it's really fantastic for that to help learners who are struggling in certain domains like medical knowledge or inpatient care to help generate cases. It's great for students to, you know, put their write-ups in there and get real-time feedback. And it's great to sort of help you give feedback to learners too, to help approach, like I give you a sort of a formulaic approach to giving feedback. So there's a lot of different aspects of AI that you can use for medical education. I try to just sort of take the person and ask them what their specific niche is and then sort of go from there.
I like that. And I like that you gave very specific examples of how it could be used in the education space. Well, turning the question over to you, Alex, as someone who teaches other faculty to embrace AI, what are some examples of some benefits you've seen with AI?
Yeah, I mean, I think AI, I see three big spheres, and this was sort of summarized really well in last year's New England Journal Review that I think has gotten just super popular in talking about AI, where you can talk about task offloading for some of the things that we do either administratively, like my fellowship letter example, or some of the administrative work we do in the EHR, like billing. We can talk about offloading of our cognitive processes for for patient care, and also thinking about the educational enhancement. We can talk about this. I'm sure we'll get to this later in our recording, but talking about some of the great work that's happening out of programs like NYU for feedback and dashboard use with residents. So there's a lot of great ways that AI can not just enhance our clinical care, but then also enhance the educational experience for our learners. So I see a lot of great opportunity as this takes off and people really start having innovative applications.
And I would say personally, definitely the cognitive load of having an AI scribe is amazing, of not having to be like, oh, I'm going to remember this later because I didn't get to type it now. It absolutely helps in clinical practice. And there's a lot of exciting new things coming along with education. If we want to kind of pivot it a little bit, there are also some risks to using AI in education. And Eric, in your workshop, you kind of mentioned this distinction between AI being a learning tool versus a shortcut, depending on the learner's intent. Can you explain what you mean by that, and how is using it as a shortcut sort of a negative that it might impair learning?
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, with any new technology, it's like a double-edged sword. Like we mentioned, we're going to be like extolling all the benefits of AI and how great it is. But, you know, if the learner is using it as a shortcut, meaning sort of to sort of circumvent the actual clinical reasoning part of their journey, that can also serve as a detriment. And it can, I think, you know, this New England Journal article that you referenced, there's this thing about like misskilling and de-skilling where you, or even never skilling, you never learn how to do something because you are over-reliant upon AI. And, you know, I think we all remember being third year medical students and having to sort of do our patient write-ups. And I remember doing like toiling over it, like for hours, making sure that it was like perfect and doing all this research. But you know, if you want to sort of get rid of all of that extra work and just put it into a chatbot or generative AI and get it done in 2 seconds, and if you become over-reliant upon that ease and that shortcut, then you're never learning how to do a patient write-up. You're never learning how to generate a differential diagnosis. So there is the potential for that like never-skilling or de-skilling that that could be a detriment to our learners in the future.
And I know you had mentioned in your workshop about how it's based on the learner's intent. I was wondering if you could speak about that a little bit more, of what that means in terms of that intent going into it.
Yeah, for sure. So if the learner wants to use AI, their intent is to help augment their skills, to help sort of take them to that next level. That's good intent. You know, if they want to use it to help them study, like if they want to generate patient cases to learn from or to help generate a study guide for their shelf, that's all good intent. But if they're using it to say, okay, I just want to get this done as quickly as possible so I can go on to something else, and not actually learn from it, that's sort of malintent, and that's using AI for, you know, maybe not the best purposes. So, but if they're coming into it saying, I want to use this as a tool to help me, that's great. But if they want to use it as a tool to sort of get out of doing the actual work, then that's the sort of downside to it.
Mm-hmm. And do we have actual knowledge data that it does de-skill people, or that...
Yeah, so the New England Journal article referenced sort of that potential of de-skilling at any level of sort of training. I think we worry most about our learners now who are, you know, in their medical training, because AI has already, it's always been there for them. But there is the potential for de-skilling even for our like trainees, like our residents and fellows who might have started their residency or their medical education journey before the generative AI bubble. But now they've got it. So, you know, if they've, again, become over-reliant upon it, then that's pretty concerning.
You know, I think it also depends on where you're introducing these tools in the training, right? You know, the risks for de-skilling and mis-skilling and never-skilling are different when you're a clerkship student versus when you're a seasoned attending. And to the point about de-skilling, there was another article about seasoned endoscopists or seasoned colonoscopists who were given access to an AI tool. Actually, their skills got worse after the AI tool. So they assessed their skills before AI introduction. They let them use AI-based polyp detection. And then after the 3 months of AI-based polyp detection, they removed it and they looked at their ability to detect polyps. And actually, their ability to independently detect polyps went down. There were some caveats on that where they were. It was about like the advanced degree of the polyp and some details with, were they actually missing clinically significant things? And the answer is probably no. But at the end of the day, the risk of de-skilling is real. And that was, again, not in learners. That was in colonoscopists with, I believe, 10 years plus experience. So we were talking like seasoned attendings.
Interesting. So in that sense, is there some guidance for when to introduce it?
I think that's probably the million-dollar question. You know, one of the cool things about this conference is that there are representatives from so many different groups, from ACGME and from, you know, the program directors and the APDs. And I think how we think about milestones around the use of AI is critically important, and how we think about does somebody need to demonstrate a certain level of competence before we let them use an ambient scribe or before we let them use a discharge compiler? Or do we think that those things are appropriate from day one of medical training, the day they hit the door in medical school, because that's going to be the reality? I'm not sure that anybody has a clear answer to that right now, but the risks of de-skilling, mis-skilling, and never-skilling are real, and they're present at every tier of our learners, and not even learners, although I would say we're all learners, still, yeah. Right? So every tier of our learners. Yeah. Well, I'm going to stick with what I said at first.
And that sounds like the major one that we're concerned about, trainees not reaching their full potential and also potentially us as attendings losing some of our skills. Are there other risks with AI that we need to be aware of in medical education?
I mean, I think, you know, there are all sorts of societal risks for AI that I'm not sure how deep we want to go down that road. But, you know, there's a lot to say about the use of the noise around the AI plants that's affecting small town America. And I mean, there's a great documentary about a town in Texas that was next to an AI plant and people who developed all these weird syndromes around that. So not even just with our pedagogy, but also just thinking about like ethical use of AI more broadly and water use and the electrical grid and all these things. I mean, there's a lot that we could say down that path. So I do have other concerns about AI, but I think the big ones with are skilling when it comes to the pedagogy, at least.
Yeah, and I think also like maintaining academic integrity as well. And I think there's also concerns about, you know, if they're, you know, plagiarizing, if they're just using completely AI-generated write-up and it's none of their work whatsoever. The only work they put in was sort of like thinking of the prompt, and then they hand in this piece of work that isn't really theirs. And then also, you know, thinking about HIPAA compliance and things like that. Obviously, in the healthcare space, you know, putting in patient information, HPI, into a chatbot that has access to the internet, that's also like concerns about HIPAA and how we like train our learners to use AI appropriately, especially when it comes to privileged patient information and to not, you know, violate HIPAA.
Mm. And I think you both hit it the nail on the head in the sense of, you know, approaching with both appreciating the benefits, but also being cautious about the risks that are there. I was wondering if we could circle back a little bit. I know you both gave broad examples of how it can be helpful in health professions education. I was wondering if you could maybe dive deep into one or two examples and kind of flesh it out a little bit more in terms of what was the benefit for AI in X, Y example.
Yeah, for sure. Like I mentioned earlier, I do a lot of remediation work and particularly like about clinical reasoning. So if there's a student who's struggling with clinical reasoning on the wards, you know, before we would sort of like have to search for a patient case and go through it. And that would be like, you know, pretty laborious for me as the preceptor to have to like, you know, go around my hospitalist workroom and say like, hey, do you have a good case for a med student that I can go through? And then, you know, finding a patient that, you know, isn't on like a 10 kinds of like isolation precautions and, you know, speaks English and is not, you know, have, you know, cognitive impairment and can actually give a linear story. And that's a lot. And it would take a lot of time for me, especially if I was like also on service, to do all this and balance this. But then what we can do is, you know, I can meet with the student, we can go and generate a case with a generative AI and have it just basically be tailored to what the student needs. Like if they have issues with generating differential diagnoses or a particular disease, like if they're really struggling with management of COPD, I can give them sort of the spectrum of COPD exacerbation from sort of like the mild cases to like the ones that are like crashing in the ICU and need ECMO and everything in between. So I found it like really, really great to sort of tailor it towards the learner's specific needs, especially in like the remediation space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so interesting. Yeah, a good creative use of AI.
To pull a couple things from the pre-course, just to highlight some of the cool things that I saw some other places. Daniel Sartori and Margaret Horlick from two of the NYU programs have created these phenomenal dashboards where it actually scans resident notes and it provides medical insights and gives critical feedback on their thinking. And it talks about quality of the note. They also have dashboards for some specific diagnoses to see the how the resident is thinking about diagnosis of things like VTE and whether there were missed opportunities for earlier diagnosis and ordering of CT scans. So really insightful tools that are actually using real-time information to try to both assess the learner, but also provide structured feedback, which is super cool. And then out of Hopkins, Hopkins. There's a group at Hopkins Bayview led by Paul O'Rourke, Alam Singh, and Janie Abernethy, who are really working on integrating ambient listening effectively into their outpatient and inpatient practices, talking about how do they train up their faculty, how do they get their learners ready and get them all standard, because a lot of people, some folks may have had exposure to AI in medical school, some may have not. And so how do you get an even playing field? So there's a lot of great work happening there for making sure the boat's being paddled in the right direction. I think it's really exciting to talk about AI in med ed right now because it's like popcorn. There's just these great things happening in every program. People are doing cool work. And I think there's a lot of reason to hope and to see that the future here is going to be really insightful and interesting.
Those are awesome examples. And I hadn't heard about that dashboard one. And I mean, that would even for attendings be so valuable. I mean, because we don't know what we're missing. And if there could be this behind the scenes, audit of the charts and you get pinged if like you made a mistake, I mean, that would be super valuable. Mm-hmm. So exciting things coming down mm-hmm. the line.
And better for patients too,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, yeah. And I just when we started using the Ambient Scribes, I feel like that would be such an amazing way of teaching or giving feedback on communication skills. It's a very different situation when someone's sitting in the room with you. But if you just have someone listening and, not someone, the AI listening, and you're not even aware of it, it's a much more natural experience. And I'm sure there are ways that we could tie that to patient satisfaction scores or outcomes or, something to be able to target. So I think there are going to be a lot of exciting options down the line.
Yeah. And I think this really ties into our next question. So as Joseph hears about both the benefits and risks of AI, he wonders about the role of institutional guidance. So some institutions have specific guidance about AI, some don't. He wasn't able to find any clear AI policies at his medical center. So I guess the question is, are these policies important / necessary? And if so, what key element should they include?
Yeah, I think the policies are important because it's sort of a way to standardize the way that an institution uses AI and teaches people how to use AI. Thing is, they're very variable, and they're not exactly page turners when you read them, and they actually are on a university or an institution's website. And getting learners to actually read them is not necessarily the most entertaining thing for them. And also, a lot of them focus on how not to use AI rather than how to like use AI appropriately. But I think it is important to have some sort of framework and structure, especially because there are people who are not as familiar with AI, and there are other attendings who really love AI. And they are really embracing it. So the students and learners get sort of this uneven modeling of what AI is and how it could be used. So I think having sort of an institutional protocol and guideline to say, hey, this is how you use AI, this is how it should be used, and this is how it shouldn't be used is helpful. But again, it's pretty discrepant between institutions. So some institutions have a really robust protocol and policy, others don't have anything. And then some are sort of in the middle.
And, so we just to highlight again some work from someone who presented the pre-course, Daniel Lugo gave us a great talk on some of the policy pieces and the legal side of this. And the two things that I took away from it were that besides the policy piece, we also have to talk about the HIPAA-compliant piece, which you referenced earlier, and thinking about what if your institution has a business associate agreement with the relevant AI vendor, so OpenEvidence being an example of one that a lot of folks are using, and that's what makes it legal for you to use HIPAA-compliant information within that vendor's tool. And it actually gets even more complicated. A concept I hadn't even considered is if you have visiting medical students, it's possible that they have HIPAA-approved tools through their medical school. But if your health institution does not have an agreement with that HIPAA tool, then that student cannot use that tool when they're at your visiting rotation because it's a patient of your healthcare institution. It's not a patient of their medical school's healthcare institution. So the legality piece gets really interesting. I didn't know anything about that. So learning about that foundational piece, I think, is something that's critical. And the policy piece really adds that transparency and expectation setting and makes it clear for people what the boundaries are. My institution is just starting to get around the policy piece now, and it's been really helpful to say, you can use this, you should use this, this is the right path. But that also means you cannot do these other tools. They're not appropriate because we don't have the right agreements or they don't have the right protections in place. And I agree with you that at the end of the day, saying no is not going to be effective. These things are happening. Our learners are putting stuff into ChatGPT all the time. Really, it's about saying, please don't do this. Please do this, and helping them understand what the appropriate frameworks and boundaries are.
Yeah. And I think also like keeping up to date with it, because that's one of the major impediments to developing these policies, is that in a few months they're going to be out of date because AI is just so rapidly changing. And then, you know, when the new iteration of a certain generative AI chatbot comes out, then, you know, you may have to adjust those protocols. They have to be very dynamic. And that's sometimes hard for institutions to keep up with, let alone like the individual attending and learners trying to keep up with all the changes as well. So it's important to have these policies and to know where they are and to know that they may be updated pretty rapidly as things change.
I think, yeah, it sounds like such an important thing to have that clarity through policies like that. I'm curious, are there resources that our listeners could look at in terms of if they're newly developing some of these policies? Are there certain resources? I know you alluded to, Alex, one of the talks that was here. Are there any other resources that are maybe more widely available, for example?
You know, I think if I were trying to start this at my institution, I would definitely start with my local people. Getting your CMO involved, getting your maybe your CIO, your chief informatics officer, and then your legal team. They did not teach me in medical school how to write BAA agreements with tech platforms. And so I would definitely look to some of those folks locally before I really went out and tried to put out my own shingle on some of that. But I have also found that everyone is interested in AI, but many people are afraid to start. And so if you're in a residency program in any role and are looking to bring this to your institution, I think once you start that conversation and you identify yourself as a champion, this is a topic which is gathering, the snowball is gathering snow fast. And so if you just say, hey, it's me, I want to do this, I suspect most places are going to be interested in pushing it forward. I have found that the edicts of no, you can't use AI is coming from a place of I don't have time to figure this out, not a place of I don't think this is valuable. And so if you're willing to help figure it out, then like put your hand up and do it.
Yeah, no, I think like starting at your institution, I think at least the major academic medical centers have bioinformatics people and sort of like their little local AI expert. And, you know, because they're most of them are associated with like large universities that have been using AI for a while. So I think finding them, linking up with them and helping even to just give like a grant rounds or something, or even like a divisional talk to your division. That's what we just had recently, where they sort of gave our gen med division a talk on AI. And it was a little workshop about how to use certain chatbots that were available at the institution, the ones that are HIPAA compliant, and how to like appropriate write a prompt to help get the information, and how it can be used for both like the med ed space, but also like the clinical aspects of it as well. So I think that was really helpful, and just sort of starting at like the local level and then moving outwards.
I think that's a good start for sort of the broader policy approach. Eric, in your workshop, you mentioned the Clerkship AI Toolkit as a practical decision framework to think about using AI with trainees. Could you explain us a little bit about that and how to use that toolkit?
Yeah, so this was sort of the brainchild of Dr. Rex Hermanson, who I'm co-presenting with along with Dr. Eve Merrill. And it's a way to sort of like circumvent the uniformity of like the policies in certain institutions. So it's sort of a way to for learners and for the academic folks to sort of assess how AI is being used. And we use this mnemonic PAIR, so P-A-I-R, AI in the middle is capitalized for obvious reasons. So it's the P is for purpose. So asking why, what is the student using this for? What is the learner using it for? What is the purpose for them using AI for whatever the assignment is? A is application. So how are they using it? How are they typing in the prompt? What sort of generative AI tool are they using? I is for integrity. I think we highlighted is to sort of maintain their professional identity formation, that they're not going to be losing all of their professionalism and their skills by using AI. And then R is the risk benefit, which I think we really belabored in the beginning of this talk, because I think it's really important, is, you know, why are they, like, what are the potential risks and pitfalls of using this, and what are the potential benefits? And if you can get the students to sort of think about this before they use it, sort of like a timeout before you do a procedure of like, okay, why am I using AI? How am I going to use it? And then what are the risks and benefits of it? And then sort of goes to the intent as well. So maybe they can sort of identify, like, what is my intent for this? Is it good? Is it for good? Is it for, like, for evil? So am I going to be able to, you know, to actually learn and grow from this? Or am I going to, dull my skills, or even, like, not develop skills as a result of this? And I think that's sort of a way to get both the learner and the teacher on the same page on how to, like, appropriately use AI for whatever the intent is.
That's really cool. It's like really deliberate practice around AI. I love that. And it's one of the easier mnemonics to remember.
So that's
really cool.
For sure.
Yeah.
Have you put that into practice? And I'm sort of envisioning, you know, a late third year clerkship student who says, you know, I've written 100 H&Ps. Why can't I just use AI to write the rest of them? Because I've got this down.
Like, I was actually recently on service, and one of my students, when I was giving them feedback, mentioned that they were using AI, and I was like, oh, this is a perfect opportunity to sort of address like how they're using AI. And you know, she had mentioned, you know, she was using it more as like a tool to sort of augment her skills and sort of identify what she was missing, which I think is a really good idea for a third year med student, because sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and you know, typing, you know, putting in your HPI into the chat bot and saying, okay, this is my write-up. Is there anything I'm missing? Or is there any evidence or articles that I can pull up about practice guidelines for the treatment of this disease that I may be missing? And that was a really great way to say like, yeah, you did a really good job of identifying like the top differentials, like the can't miss, but here are some of the maybe more esoteric ones that you might not know of. And then, you know, she learned from that and they pulled in papers. So it was actually really helpful, and she was using AI in the appropriate way. And it was a good idea. And we went through like the paranormonic of like, you know, why she was doing it. And then sort of, I think that helped expand her knowledge base, but not saying like, okay, patients coming in with like chest pain and shortness of breath, like tell me what it is and give me a write-up about it. And then like, that's obviously not a great way to use AI, but she was using it appropriately. And I think moving forward, like I always see like, you know, when I'm on rounds, I'm paying attention to everyone on their phones and seeing like, okay, they've got Open Evidence open. Okay, they've got ChatGPT open. I know they're typing in stuff as like we're talking, but you know, how they're using it, I think, is the more important talking point.
Yeah, I like the example, and I like addressing it head on in that way. And, you know, it seems like the tool is quite practical in that sense.
Yeah. And I think it sort of skirts around like AI shaming too. Because if you have an attending who maybe isn't like the most up to date on AI, or like has a very like negative view about AI, and all they do is like constantly, you know, put down AI and saying, okay, people who use AI are lazy and they don't recognize any of the benefits, students are going to be using it regardless. But now they're just not going to be forthcoming about, hey, I used AI to help me with this talk or this presentation, or I used it to help generate this differential diagnosis for this like very complicated, undifferentiated patient. And then that's not great, because if they're hiding the use of AI, you're not going to be able to know when they're using it. You're not going to be able to address any potential knowledge gaps that they may be masking with the AI. So I think being upfront and honest, like, hey, everyone's using AI. I use AI. Like, I tell them like when I'm using AI as well. But you know, how to use it appropriately and sustainably and ethically, I think modeling that behavior for our learners is really important.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I think also this toolkit seems like it's quite applicable, not just for clerkship learners, but also other types of learners in different levels as well.
Yeah, I'm mostly in the GME space, so I do it with my residents all the time. I think it's like very like broadly applicable to like any stage, even myself as an attending.
And Alex, any other frameworks that you've seen and use or that you could find helpful?
You know, back to the New England Journal article we referenced early on, Deft AI is just another framework to talk about how we're integrating AI. And it's sort of, I'm not going to go through the whole mnemonic because people can look it up pretty easily, but I think of it akin to the one-minute preceptor for outpatient medicine, where you're really just trying to critically appraise like where is your thinking and then where is AI's thinking and how are we integrating AI in deliberate practice? But I got to be honest, I like your mnemonic more than Deft AI, because the challenge, Deft doesn't have a meaning to me in AI, but PAIR, you get the acronym, there's the AI in the middle, I'm into it.
Did you use AI to make it?
I'll have to ask Rex, but I think he's a very clever guy, so I think he came up with it on his own.
Going back to our case and reflecting over the past year, Joseph feels like the pace of evolution for AI is very rapid, like a snowball, kind of rolling downhill, like you were mentioning before. He is curious about how medicine and health professions education will continue to change with AI. Both of you have already spoken about the current atmosphere of AI in education and some already existing tools. But I was wondering if you can both kind of talk about what is the future of AI. You know, what are some things maybe not currently here yet, but maybe on the horizon, or where do you foresee things going?
I think I'm really hopeful that AI is going to fix our interface with the computer, both in the way that we integrate the work with the EHR, but also the way that patients work with the EHR. And then, you know, even we talk about EHRs, but actually it's become this really complex landscape of all these background add-on features too, that are all really shoehorned in to work into one system that don't actually really work that well together. And so I'm really hoping that AI will solve that. And so there's a lot of individual interventions that are moving towards that goal. What I'm hopeful is that the future brings us back to what we want to do, which is be at the bedside. I don't personally see a universe where AI is actually replacing us at the bedside. I'm sure you could come up with examples where patients are going to be asking robots questions about their health, but I think at the end of the day, there's going to be a core function for the doctor and the patient going through things together, and I hope it gets us back to that. You know, it may be a universe where we're seeing far more patients, or we are responsible for far more patients and supervising our AI robots to do whatever it is that they're going to do. And then we get involved with a couple of key cases. But nonetheless, what that looks like to me is spending more time with individual patients and less time at the computer. You know, I was talking to my interns a couple of weeks ago. We're talking about computer space at our hospital and number of workstations and all those things. And my intern, I asked them one day, estimate for me what percent of your day you spend at the computer. And he, without a breath, said 70% of my day. And if we can get that fixed, whatever the interventions are in the future and the path, I am really hopeful that that problem will get better, no matter what it looks like. That's where I'm hoping.
Yeah, I think I absolutely agree. You know, even myself, like admitting a patient who has had a very like complex hospital course at another institution and then having to like search for all the things, even with Care Everywhere on Epic, it's still not perfect. And then some of, you know, some institutions, you really can't see everything. Maybe you see like a one-line summary of a very complex hospital course. So if AI can sort of synthesize all of the things that were done or have me like, you know, okay, can you summarize the last like 10 CAT scans of the chest this patient had so I don't have to sort of go through all of these, you know, these reports. I think that's really helpful to sort of minimize the amount of time I'm actually like searching and then typing my note and then talking to the patient. I think the most important thing is talking to the patient. And I think, you know, there's all this talk about AI replacing physicians, but I think it's still, we need the human aspect there as well, because I think, you know, these are generative AI. So they, you know, it's predictive. It's not actually, you know, thinking on its own. So if you ask, that part of the workshop we did as our divisional conferences, you know, we each type the same prompt into Open Evidence, and it was about sort of someone coming in with aspiration pneumonia and asking about treatment for this patient. And, you know, there were about 10 or 15 of us in the group, and like most of us got different responses. Some of them, they were all pretty similar theme, but different nuances that you really needed the actual like clinical nuance of a physician who's been practicing for a while to say, okay, yeah, I'm not going to put this patient on steroids, or I'm not going to use this. Like one was recommending Amsulbactam, and then another one was recommending Ceftriaxone. So it was like different antibiotics, different different treatments, different methods of oxygen delivery. So again, you still need that human aspect there to help guide it. But I think it can, you know, sort of do the cognitive offloading part and help us spend more time with our patients, which is, I think, you know, why we went into medicine in the first place.
And I think what we have to teach is going to change. We need to teach people how to assess AI output, yeah, to know that, you know, that antibiotic that it's recommending is actually a reasonable choice. Mm-hmm. And there are, you know, regional distinctions based on resistance and yada, yada, yada. And that's what we need to be teaching people. I'm probably going to, you know, get in trouble for saying this, but I also think that there are things that we don't need to be teaching anymore. I think the reality is first-year medical students are probably never going to have to read EKGs. I mean, why couldn't AI do that in a short number of years? Now, sure, in the advanced EP world where they're doing stuff that I don't understand, there was always going to be a role for electrophysiologic interpretation. But like the basic EKG reading, like I'm just not sure that AI is not going to take that over. PFTs, another great example. And we've seen this creep over time in other ways too. I mean, how many of us at this table have spun a urine and actually looked at it under the microscope or looked at a blood smear? Those are other things that we have seen technology and different processes replace. So although it may sound uncomfortable to think we're not reading EKGs anymore, which by the way, is not happening now, but I'm just predicting what the next 2 years is going to bring. Even though that is what I'm predicting, that concept and those things becoming defunct is something that we've experienced time and time again in medicine. I don't think is inherently bad. We just have to offload those things from our learning so we can put in other learnings that we think are now relevant to the current state.
And in your programs, do you have any formal sessions with the trainees around assessing the validity of AI or using it appropriately? I mean, Eric, sounds like you're sort of doing it on the fly when you're precepting, but is there anything, do you have like a curriculum or anything?
Not yet, but I think it's going to be something that we definitely need to do, because I agree with you that we really do need to have them assess the output for like the validity and the biases. And there's also this like component of like sycophantry with AI where it really just like hypes you up and gasses you up and like, wow, that's the greatest thing I've ever heard of. Like, let me tell you why you're right, where you may not be right. And then you sort of get that halo effect. You're like, wow, I'm great. I asked such a great question. And that, you know, I think you need to have that you have to step back and say, just like you do with everything, like trust but verify. I tell all of my residents and my students that. Same thing with AI. So when you get that output, make sure that it's not hallucinating. Make sure that the article that it references is an actually really an article. Make sure that it's appropriate, that the guidelines that they're referencing are appropriate for your patient. And I think that's really still important. And I think that's part of a lot of the policies reference, like making sure you have checking the validity of the output, but how that's actually put into practice is very variable.
And, I think, Eric, you talked about this in the way that you demonstrate your AI use in the wards. I think one of the biggest challenges we face is that the learners are coming along faster than the attendings. And so who is demonstrating appropriate use and appropriate practice? Who is actually showing how to use open evidence on the wards in a patient encounter in a way that's HIPAA compliant and additive and doesn't take away from our clinical reasoning? Who's demonstrating that? Yeah. I think there's very few attendings who are actually out there doing that. So I agree that we need to be thinking about curricula for this, but I also think the faculty development piece is so important, because if the faculty aren't doing it, then I think it's great to have our trainees leading the edge, but we don't want the trainees to be the only ones leading the edge, because we need someone driving the ship who has some experience too, to make sure that we aren't running into all these pitfalls of de-skilling and misskilling along the way.
I think that's such an interesting point and such a relevant point of maybe younger learners being more seasoned in how to use AI. What would you advise for faculty that maybe aren't as comfortable and maybe just really starting out in terms of gaining that comfort, gaining those skills?
Yeah, you gotta dabble. You gotta try some stuff. I think of it like the Daniel Kahneman System 1 and System 2 thinking. Like, you gotta build your AI System 1. Like, right now, if you are AI naive, you are living in System 2, where you see the output and you have no idea what to do with that. And so you gotta just play with it, and you gotta see where the pitfalls are. You have to try something. And I think if I could give every attending one request, it would be, pick one thing to try an AI in your next service block or clinic block. It could be ambient listening. It could be asking a question to open evidence. It could be, I can't even think of something right now, but try one thing. And, we're medical educators. Make a SMART goal for yourself. Like, it's not that deep, right? And I would just hope that if attendings can start dabbling, they at least won't be left behind. And then they can start to demonstrate what the right behaviors look like.
Yeah, what I usually tell folks is, like, every attending sort of has their standard chalk talk that they go to, whatever it is. And I say, you know your chalk talk inside and out. So type that into a chatbot or generative AI and say, what can I do to improve this? Or even just say, my chalk talk is on hyponatremia. So ask ChatGPT or one of those chatbots to give me a 5-minute chalk talk that I can give on rounds on hyponatremia and compare it to your own. And then that's a good way to sort of see this is really, really good. Or, hey, they missed this. They approached it in a different way that I don't usually do. And then, then build upon that. And then, you can get more specific with your prompts, especially tailor it to a third year med student or tailor it to, a nephrology fellow. And then this is you can see, okay, these are the different outputs, and then sort of just again, go from there. I think that's how we all started, because again, we're part of that cohort where generative AI happened well into our careers, and no one sort of sat down with us and said, okay, this is how you should use AI. Or this, I was just, opening up ChatGPT and I was like, oh, okay, I need to give a talk on acute hypoxemic respiratory failure. And then it just gave me something. And again, there were really great parts, and there were parts where I'm like, okay, this isn't necessarily right, but it gave me a jumping off point where I can sort of, augment my lecture. And I thought it was, that's how I really started. So.
Great examples. Mike, how do you use it? What'd you say? What would you recommend for Joseph? What would his...
I am absorbing these tips and we'll use it more. I think for me...
Oh, so you are Joseph. Okay.
I think it's kind of sometimes happenstance. I am trying to use it more for maybe more personal things in terms of, searching for whatever, or, travel planning. But I definitely want to use open evidence more in terms of exploring its use. I can see a lot of benefit for that in terms of patient care. How about you, Molly?
I'd say prior auth letters is amazing.
Yeah.
You don't want to think about it. You actually don't care about it. You just want it to say everything it needs to say. And they do a great job on open evidence of appeal letters.
Well, those are great tips in terms of for faculty to really feel more comfortable. I'm kind of curious if you all have any tips on how to teach learners and other faculty as well about critical appraisal. You were talking about, double checking what AI generates. How do you go about teaching that, the critical appraisal piece?
Yeah, I think it's just sort of the same way we approach all evidence-based medicine and at journal clubs, making sure that, you're being critical of the paper that you're reading, not just taking it as sort of the gospel truth. The same thing with generative AI. So when you put in your prompt and it gives you something, read it, but don't take it at face value. Sort of make sure you're cross-referencing. Like Open Evidence does a great job of actually providing you with the links to the article. Again, making sure that they're real articles. And then reading the article itself, not just saying, okay, because the summary sometimes isn't necessarily 100% accurate, or again, 100% applicable to your patient. So making sure that you're assessing it for the limitations of the study and making sure that it's, you know, that it's valid for your question for your patient, and just sort of treating it like another piece of evidence-based medicine in the way that we critically appraise all of it.
Someone at the AI pre-course, it might have been our intro speaker, Anoop Agarwal, or someone, I can't remember who said this, but they had a great example they do with their interns during intern orientation where they have a video of a patient encounter. And they play the video of the patient encounter, and the PD has, unbeknownst to the room, an ambient tool listening and summarizing the encounter, and they tell all the interns to then write the HPI for the patient. And then together they compare then they share what the ambient listener produced, and then they get the opportunity to compare what they wrote down as their HPI and what the ambient tool wrote down for the HPI. And you see the pitfalls plain as day, that it captures some things excellent, but then it also hallucinates some things. We were talking about, this is one of the ambient tools that throws chest pain into every problem list if it's anywhere in the history. And you have to know that that's a cognitive error that it makes. So there's all these great micro examples of how to do it. But again, I think it really comes down to someone has to demonstrate it. Someone has to use it and do it in a way that's signposted and showing the room, this is how I use AI in a way that is effective, ethical, constructive, dedicated, and thoughtful. And until we have faculty and champions who are willing to do that work, I think it's going to be really hard just to have a curriculum that you press play on to teach your learners about AI. I'm just not sure that that's achievable.
And it's evolving so quickly that
100%.
Even if you made it now, in 6 months it would be different, and that's very hard to keep up on. And in your programs, what kind of limitations are, like, are you giving your residents ambient scribes? Are you?
Yeah, we don't have that at our institute. I think some of the outpatient faculty practices have it, but the resident ones don't yet. But I think, again, you know, it's a matter of time. I think most spaces are going to start moving towards this to sort of, again, offload those sort of clerical aspects of our work. But I think, again, making sure that, you know, you're proofreading it and going through it to make sure that there's no hallucinations or things that are going to be, you know, detrimental to the case.
Yeah, we have ambient available for all attendings at this point, but not for, it's still turned off for the residents. I think it's probably a mix of cost of licensing, but then also, again, we just don't know what level is appropriate to start introducing that. Again, that's going to change. Ambient's going to become available. And then the other, we have the chart compiler, which you can ask it questions to summarize pieces of the patient's chart, which is actually really helpful, but definitely has pitfalls. My smart goal for myself the last time I was on service was to, rather than chart biopsying all my patients on my first day myself, was to use the hospital course summary from the AI tool. And it was a helpful summary, but it was not granular enough for the level of detail that I needed as the taking over attending. And so it's, again, you got to just try and see what the pitfalls are.
And I think that's a really important point, to like know what it's missing. Because again, if you're an early learner, you might not know, okay, it didn't give me all the information that I needed. You're like, oh, this is great. It gave me this huge summary, but you're missing a lot of crucial aspects that are critical for patient care. So having that more seasoned attending who understands, like, hey, yeah, this is great, but it missed, you know, the differential on their CBC that showed they had, you know, eosinophilia. Mm-hmm. So that's super important. And, you know, if you don't know that you're supposed to be looking for that, you're going to miss it. So I think having someone to sort of point out, like, yeah, this is great, but I think that's the important part.
Yeah, great. Yeah, appreciated those different snapshots and kind of how you both approach it, or your institutions approach it. There are some health profession students who have noted their concern about the energy implications for use of AI in health professions education. And then we also talked about a couple other things in terms of ethical implications as well. I don't think this is a theoretical situation, but some students have declined participation in activities where they're asked to work with a chatbot to simulate a patient case or review learning from a recent session. How would you approach having these conversations with learners. And, you know, as you talk about things like the energy, climate, ethical implications of AI in education.
I mean, I think these are all real issues. And, you know, there are a lot of different places right now where personal ethic and what's happening in our immediate world or in our residency programs is in conflict with how we feel about whatever that issue may be. And I think AI and climate is one of those overlaps. As when I'm putting on my program director hat and thinking about mentorship, my role is not to tell people what to believe or feel or think about AI, but it's to help them find a career path that is valuable to them and then help them build that path. So my approach to that conversation, I think being a medical learner and being avoidant to AI is not conducive to a career in medicine at this point, to be frank. I think if you want to avoid all AI, that's just not going to be possible in medicine. And so really understanding what that person's barriers are and what their lines are and helping them hone out what matters to them and why, and then thinking about how that fits with their career and what their future should look like in that context, and trying to do some prioritization, because, you know, it is more nuanced and complicated than just saying, I don't feel comfortable using AI. And again, I'm not trying to be overly simplistic, but I just don't think that medicine is going to move away from AI. I just don't see a future where AI is not a part of our lives. And I'm not sure that one could be effective in the next couple of years if they totally avoided it.
Yeah, I think those are really, really great points. And I think acknowledging the environmental impacts of AI and not sort of sweeping it under the rug, I think that's something like that's the elephant in the room that we should all be aware of. But I also try to bring it to sort of the environmental impacts of healthcare as a whole, which I don't think a lot of people are necessarily aware of, that healthcare does have a huge environmental impact, even from the things that we do every day on the wards. Like when you order phlebotomy for your patients, remember like all of the equipment that you need for that, the phlebotomy kits, the tubes, and then having to manufacture them, ship them to the hospital. The whole sort of, chain of command from getting from like the factory to the hospital and then disposing it, that all generates an environmental impact. The same thing with like the isolation gowns, every time you're putting it on and taking it off and then throwing it out, that has to be manufactured, shipped to the hospital, stored, and then disposed of appropriately. So that all has environmental impact. So the way that you always sort of do like the choosing wisely and making sure that you're not over ordering labs for patients, I also think of it from the environmental spin, like, you know, do we really need all of this stuff for our patients? Is it absolutely necessary? And then you're using AI in the same way. You're thinking of like, do I need AI to do this for me? Or can I do it on my own? Do I need to be over reliant upon this? Or do I use AI for everything that I'm doing, or just for certain aspects? And I tell my learners, and I just even myself, you know, making sure that I'm using AI responsibly, ethically, sustainably, because I am aware that it has a huge environmental impact as well. But again, trying to avoid it entirely and saying, okay, well, I'll just get by without it. Maybe now you could, but I think as in a few years from now, I think it's just going to be so ingrained, not only in like medical education, it's going to be like day one of med school, it's going to be integrated, and then residency and fellowship. We're going to have learners who are, you know, attendings who are, you know, having AI since the beginning of their medical education. So it's going to be very, very hard to sort of extricate yourself from that entirely. So I think being aware of the environmental impacts and how we can sort of minimize them, but, you know, not avoiding it entirely.
You said that better than I did. I appreciate that.
Yeah, that's great. Well, thanks. This has been great. Are there other aspects from your talk that we didn't cover, or things that you want to cover?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a fun workshop. I'm doing it like right after this.
Oh, okay.
But I think it's we have a couple of interesting cases to go through to apply the parent mnemonic to, and I think just getting people to think about AI and how it can be a tool for good, and like also emphasizing the good that it does, but also being aware that again, it's not a perfect technology. Nothing is, and being aware of the pitfalls, but not sort of just emphasizing only the pitfalls that you sort of try to steer learners away from AI, or that do that AI shaming, where they're now going to still be using it, but not being upfront and honest with it. And then again, being aware of that misskilling, deskilling, and never skilling, and being on top of it to avoid it from when it, you know, for yourself and especially for your learners.
And Alex, any other main themes that came up during the pre-course, things that we haven't mentioned yet, or did we cover?
I think we touched a lot. I think if I had one takeaway, it would be just try some stuff, get out there and play with it. Don't be afraid to do it in secret and, you know, your office when nobody's looking. So like if you have a typo, like it doesn't yell at you, and it's all okay. Like AI does not bite back.
Yeah.
Well, at the end of our recording, we always give our guests a chance to plug something they're working on, recent publication, important resource, anything like that. But maybe we'll start with Eric. Anything you want to?
Yeah, sure. I'm currently one of the digital media fellows for the Journal of Hospital Medicine. So we're doing a lot of work on visual abstracts and video visual abstracts. So it's across our social media platforms. So we're on Instagram, LinkedIn, Threads and Blue Sky. So you can check us out in the stuff that's going on at the journal.
I'm on the program planning committee for Aptum. So I think if I didn't plug our fall meeting, I would get in trouble. So, you know, please all join in Kentucky, Louisville, Kentucky, October 15th to 17th. It's going to be another great meeting.
Amazing. Thank you. Well, really appreciate both your time. This has been great and gives us lots to think about. And, you know, it'll be exciting to see where this goes in a few years.
Yeah. Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Thanks, Rose.
So that was such a great conversation, Mike. It was really fun to sit down in person here at the Alliance and talk about AI. I would say my take-home point is to try to be more intentional about modeling how I try to appraise AI and sort of showing learners different prompts that I might use in looking up a clinical question using AI, for example, open evidence, and kind of looking about how different prompts could give me different responses, or actually trying to like follow those papers to make sure that the answer that I'm getting is reliable. So trying to model some more of that critical appraisal that's we can build on top of using AI. What about you? What would you say your take-home points are?
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, and I think I agree. It's such a good and timely conversation. I think the snowball is coming. So I think for me, I was just thinking about how it's good to have a thoughtful approach when thinking about AI, both with learners as well as with oneself. So I know we talked about the Clerkship AI Toolkit and then the acronym PAIR. So thinking about purpose for using it, application, what you're applying it for, integrity of what you're getting out of it, and the risk benefits of it. So really being thoughtful as opposed to not whenever you use it for self, for clinical things, but also especially as you teach learners about it. So yeah, a lot of rich information in this discussion.
This has been another episode of our Curbsiders series, The Curbsiders Teach. Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/teach. A special thanks to the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine for making this season possible. Thanks to Dr. Matt Watto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support in this project. Thank you to the team at PodPaste for editing and production support. Until next time, I've been Dr. Molly Hoyblein.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or you can contact us at thecurbsidersteach@gmail.com. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. I've been Dr. Mike Chang. Thank you for joining us today and letting us bring you a little nugget of medical edutainment.